Okay. Let's just take up a generalized look at the notice X scale this morning, huh? You think you've seen this thing and you know all about this thing, but the very funny thing is, it's a very, very, very good indicator on the part of your preclear. It lands a very good category of things for you to use in addressing processes through preclear. It becomes particularly important when you start working such a thing as 8D, or when you take up problems, or when you take up granting of beingness. Now, notice X scale, of course, is subdivided so that you could say that there's a line breaking all of existence in half, above which line you'd have a notice X scale, and below which line you would have a notice X scale. And you could say that the difference between these two notice X scales would be that the upper one had something good about each one, and the lower one had something bad about each one. Your preclear, for instance, who knows that sex is bad, is at the bottom of the bottom scale. And when they come up tone scale, they don't come up to knowing, this is what's important about this, you see, is they don't come up scale knowing that sex is good. That isn't the consideration which you immediately change with the preclear. You'll get there eventually, but what they come up scale knowing is that eating is bad. Got that? And now they don't change their minds to the direction so much and routinely that eating is good. They get up to the fact that symbols are bad. And that now thinking is bad. And now that effort is bad. And now that emotion is bad, and now that perception is bad, and finally that knowingness is bad, and then they'll find something good about sex. Now, I've watched these people operate this way, and the broad breakdown of these two scales, however, is slightly misleading in view of the fact that the whole tone scale arrangement is a geometric dwindling. It's really not a geometric dwindling. It's a scale which runs this way. Supposing you were going to Chicago and you went halfway, and then you stopped and decided you were going to go halfway to Chicago. So you went and got the remainder halfway. And then you decided to go to Chicago at this new point, and you went halfway. And now you decided to go to Chicago, and you went halfway again. And now you decided to go to Chicago, and you went halfway again. You'd be getting closer and closer to Chicago, but theoretically, you would actually never reach Chicago. You see that? But your distances are splitting there each time, and you're getting a much narrower distance, so that you would have, just like it shows there in book one, that first graph, the graph of survival, it demonstrates that you've got wide lines, wide spaces between the lines at the top, and these get narrower and narrower and narrower. They come to the bottom till it's almost a continuous black line by the time you get down to zero on that scale. You see that? So that the truth of the matter is, the notice X scale, because of the ARC triangle, has in it the factor of width or distance. You see, it's how loosely are the particles together. And when you move from know to look, it really isn't a question of particles. See, the difference between know and look is the fact you've introduced some particles into things. See, we don't have a problem of infinitely smaller particles, infinitely further apart as we go on up so much. We just run up into no particles, you see, and then we come down, we run into some particles, which is look, and then perception, and so on, and we run into about a double amount of particles, half as far apart when we get into emotion, just a highly generalized statement, and then we run into twice again as many particles, half again as far apart when we get into the first effort band, so on. We get into that lower effort band now. Of course, we have come downscale. No look, emote, effort, so forth. Now when we've gone all the way through to sex, you see, and got down into lower scale, boy, are we getting condensed stuff. So the lower sex is tremendously condensed, whereas the upper sex band would be fairly light and airy. See that? It actually graphs behavior. Now, that's just an analog, but it graphs behavior fairly accurately. A person who knows sex is bad is so darn condensed on the subject. That is to say, it's all packed in. There's no face involved in the thing, and you've got to get right up close and so on. That when that comes apart, it would have to spring apart, according to this analog, it would have to spring apart an enormous distance in order to get good sex, you see. When it just springs apart a little bit, these same particles, concepts, distance, we get into bad eating. And then from bad eating, we go to bad symbols, and we go to, you know, the form. We're not going to eat the forms. We're not going to procreate with the forms, but just the fact those forms are just all bad, you see. You know, they're just bad. I mean, they're poorly constructed, and they don't run right, and they say, yeah, and so on. And we would go on up the line. When we got up to that upper sex scale, we would find that this person would really have to be worked on very solidly, clear across the boards, to be convinced that sex is bad. See that? You're not going to take some child and solitarily convince them all on this one subject that sex is bad. We're not going to take this child who was in good shape, let's say, and do something independent of anything else, which is going to convince this child that sex is now bad. We're just not going to accomplish that, that's all. In order to accomplish it, we would have to weave into it these other factors. That knowingness was bad, we'd have to suppress knowingness. That looking at anything sexual was bad, and so suppress lookingness. That any kind of emotion of that character was bad, and so suppress and condense, you might say, suppress, condense, same thing, emotingness. That the effort itself involved in the thing was very bad, and so suppress effort. That thinking about it was bad, and so suppress thinkingness to bring it down to the lower band. To suppress again the entire field of eatingness and demonstrate that was, pardon me, symbols. All sexual symbols are bad, and then eatingness is bad, and then now we've got them sold on the idea that sex is bad. Behavior is determined to a large degree by this. We don't take a child of five, give them one sexual experience, which doesn't contain a lot of other elements. We don't give them just one sexual experience and have them turn up with the concept at the age of 16 that all sex is bad. See that? We'd have to go through an arduous routine which would suppress every other factor on the notice sex scale in order to get them down into sex is bad. Let's think this over for a moment and see why it looks to you that auditing produces gradual results. That's because you look at it this way. You see, it doesn't produce necessarily gradual results. It can produce fast results. But let's look at it here and see here that we have somebody who has a very bad idea about sex. You know, sex is bad. And we decide that after 10 minutes of auditing, we're going to give them the idea that sex is all right now. No, you won't. Not unless in that 10 minutes of auditing, you have run the gamut. It's gone from sex, eating, symbols, looking, thinking, effort, emoting, looking, knowingness. All these things get turned on, and one fine day, the person wakes up with this same target that you started in on originally. You want to make sex good for them, you see. And they get into this same target area, and suddenly sex seems to be all right to them. You see what you've done there? You had to turn over all the face cards before you finally got the next face card on the subject of sex. Now, what's our problem here in terms of auditing? The problem is that a preclear is fixed on the subject of life, or dispersed on the subject of life. Fixed or dispersed on life. And life is subdivisible into these various factors, each one more condensed than the next. Knowing, looking, emoting, everything, thinking, symbols, eating, sex. That's a pretty fair compartmentation of life. You could say all these things break down into knowing. They sure do. But before we can get anybody to return his mind over entirely and change his mind completely on any one subject, it seems to be necessary to change his mind on the entire line of the know-to-sex scale. And then we will find, after we've long since given up, if we didn't know this, we would find that he would have changed his mind about one of these basic elements. So that it's good now. In other words, you're not going to take a preclear, and this is for sure. You're not going to take a preclear and turn the card over on one item and be secure that the card is turned over on that item. One of the reasons for this is that all parts of this scale have particles in them. Every part of this scale has a particle in it, except the upper knowingness scale. See that? Every part of it. And as long as an individual is allergic to space and allergic to particles in any way whatsoever, he's going to cross-connect one to another in these subjects wherever particles enter of any kind or where space enters in any way. And so we get a situation there where we're gradually getting him to change his mind about various kinds of particles until we get him to change his mind about all kinds of particles. We're gradually getting to change his mind about one kind of space until he changes his mind about all kinds of space, at which time he would be entirely free. Therefore, an auditor who selects out an individual and basic target in a case and concentrates entirely and completely upon that target can expect very, very poor results. Let me give you a case in point. There's case history in this in our very culture. And that is Sigmund Freud. He put his attention entirely upon the subject of sex and found out that very often his patients would start talking to him about bad eating. You know, they'd go from a bad sex to a bad eating. And then he considered that he had merely shifted their attention slightly, but really hadn't shifted their condition a great deal. And the work over a period of 60 years developed by the way, it was quite interesting, mystery, which it was where they entered it. They entered the mystery, of course, is what you would call lower level knowingness. And that's just mystery again. You understand it's just the scale turning over. You've got know at the top. Now when we go, we've got mystery to sex. Mystery to miss sex. Know to sex on the upper band. Mystery to miss sex on the lower band. He started in with mystery. He still retained a lot of this in his writings. He had such things as mythology, dreams. Boy, if you don't think a dream isn't a mysterious knowingness. That's what it is. A dream is a mystery. And he went from dreams and looking around this and that, when he was with Breuer. Breuer was a hypnotist. And they used hypnotism, vast mystery of, in order to produce their first results, and simply by revealing a few mysteries to their patients under hypnotic trance, why they came up the line eventually to Freud's magnificent discovery, sex, libido theory, 1894. His announcement of the libido theory. Well, he had come out of a wide band of dreams, hypnosis, hocus-pocus, mystery, and had found out this astonishing thing. And he found it out in that field of mystery, in that lower band of knowingness called mystery, that if you could suddenly reveal that a mystery was not insolvable to a patient, you could then attain some rise in his emotional structure. He discovered this, you see. I mean, that's a pretty good discovery. It was not bad observation at all. But if he'd looked at it a little harder, he would have found that his recognition theory only holds just so far, and then gets into particles and the business of livingness and so forth at the band of sex. Once we've climbed then around through mystery, we found out that if you spring a few mysteries for an individual, well, he's liable to feel better. Well, ever so often, you know, he would have a terrific failure, which was inexplicable to him. Well, this was the fellow he had sprung some mysteries on who already had a scarcity of mystery. And naturally, you'd just take one too many mysteries away from this boy, and of course he would get worse. And he would go down into the lower look band and start to look for new mysteries. Mystery to look. Now, I'll go into that a little more in a moment, but let's take a look at this and see that after he worked there on mystery for a long time, why, he got up into sex, and then he stressed sex very heavily, and before he had gone too long with his libido theory, he discovered himself into the eatingness band. And he parked psychiatry right there as of 1924, for instance. William Allen White once said to me, "Well, I don't think that this sexual fixation which Freud had was entirely embracing of everything, because it's obvious that if you put somebody down at a table who's very hungry, a man, let's say, we put him at a table, he's very hungry, and we stand a naked woman in front of him, and we put a plate of food before him, that he will eat the food, and maybe after he has eaten the food, why, he will become interested in the woman, but he will not become interested in the woman until he's eaten the food." So it's very obvious that eating has more to do with the problem than sex. Well, that was William Allen White. He's a very brilliant man. Yeah, he was the director of St. Elizabeth's. But that's the government institution. Nevertheless, though, they just stopped right there. They had observations, and the big argument was whether or not eating or sex formed the basic line. And the funny part of it was, is they never looked back at mystery again. Neither did Freud. He fooled around with his Oedipus complexes and so forth and didn't realize he was being far more of a mystery than anybody could possibly assimilate. Now, so they got stuck on this argument. Was it eating or was it sex? And they'd find somebody who was stuck on the subject of eating, and they'd find somebody who was stuck on the subject of sex. And they tried to correlate these two things, and they didn't do anything about these things really at all. Somewhere in between there, an individual had excretion mixed up with a sexual act. They recognized this. People would hold on to excretia. They would save it, you might say, and hoard it, and so forth, and this fitted in there someplace, but they weren't quite sure where. And they never moved out of those two bands. Naturally, you could hardly expect them to to move out of those bands, because they were not doing any kind of a philosophic observation. They were simply scrambling around trying to keep people from getting too violent, and they themselves were way below the effort band. None of these men would have done an honest day's work if you'd held a gun on them. And that's, I mean, now that's very cruel of me to say that, but it's true. We look over their own histories, all the people engaged in that, young Adler, Freud himself, and so forth, and we don't find any of these men anything like sympathetic toward activity. They by the way, you see, I knew people, and the people who were trained by these people, and if there was anything they were in awe of, it was somebody who engaged in sports. So this fellow was phenomenal to them. They knew this was very good somehow or another, but they couldn't quite put their finger on it. And to this day, it is enough to tell a psychiatrist that, and prove to him that you are very energetic and engaged in sports, to have him dismiss you immediately as being completely sane. I mean, it's just being
He says, well, he goes into apathy right at that point. That's the truth. It was an interesting thing, for instance, to William Allen White and Commander Thompson, both of them, where I was concerned, that I wasn't very interested in sitting around figuring about this stuff, and didn't seem to be terribly interested in the insane. I still wanted to know something about the human mind and how it worked. You see, a mind misworking was their level of acceptance, and just knowing how a mind worked as a piece of information was quite different. This was a different look, an entirely different look. And they decided that I could never possibly have been serious, or never at any time was really serious about it, most of the time because I spoke jokingly, rather facetiously about some of these things, and particularly because I was always tearing around the countryside doing something in the field of sports. If I was to be located any place, it'd be down in the golf links, at least. And they couldn't be found down in the golf links themselves. This difference of point of view affected my work in early days very strongly, because my immediate reaction toward all this was that these guys are too lazy to live, and they won't get out and look around life and the world and see what's going on, and therefore they have a short view. This was certainly not true of Commander Thompson, but I didn't realize it wasn't true of him for years. That man, by the way, has contributed to many fields. He's drawn up catalogs of snakes and ancient races and gone out in jungles and dug up more bones than could be comfortably used by a fertilizer plant. And he nevertheless was not himself energetic. He used to sit on the edge of his bunk. One of the things the Navy objected to about the man, he was a fabulous character, I really ought to tell you about him someday, but anyway, he would sit on the edge of his bunk and read until he got sleepy, fully clothed, you see, in uniform, and fall over sideways and sleep till morning, and then get up and stick a fresh pack of cigarettes in his pocket or something like that and wander off the compound. His executive officer at any hospital he was attached to was the one who invariably did all the work of the hospital. Thompson never did any of this work. Quite fabulous. Very interesting fellow. Well, anyway, it took psychologists to come up into the field of symbols. Let's look at this thing evolving and find man digging himself out of the mire here. He came up into the field of symbols. And now he reintroduced mystery in the form of dreams again. Symbols, symbols, symbols. And there are whole schools of thought in the field of psychology which are expressly devoted to symbols. And these schools, by the way, undoubtedly color your thought with regard to the mind. They couldn't help but do so. Let's look at an intelligence test, so-called. And what do we find it but a test of symbols? You should recognize that. But whether or not this square compares with that square, you know? This kind of testing, that kind of testing, 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 most of their testing is just on the basis of symbols. And when they move up any place, they put an arithmetical or calculating pitch on the thing and go up into figure, figure, figure. So an intelligence test consists of how well can you match up symbols and how long can you figure, figure, figure without going nuts. Never occurred to any of these fellows to gauge the mind on the accuracy with which an individual could pitch a ball. Let's look at that. A fellow's mind must be in pretty good shape if he can pitch a ball. See that? And they measured his mind as to whether or not he could figure, 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 or look at symbols. Well, the fixation of looking at symbols was a complete avoidance of looking at life. And so these people, of course, didn't collect any data to amount to anything. Five students indoctrinated in that particular field will stand around a rat maze, and give you five different reports on exactly what happened in that rat maze. They're not even looking, because they're way down below the look band. Effort. How did the mind tie into effort? Effort was not below figure. Not by a long ways. It was way up above it. Just up above it. Because a man figures in order to avoid effort. He figures in order to make effort use effort. You see that engineering itself is the study of how you make effort use effort? Well, that certainly isn't confronting effort, is it? It's handling it on a very covert basis. All right. If you told a modern engineer, now look, there's a, we've got 2,500 men down here and we want a pyramid built. He'd say, well, all right, but let's see, I'll need several bulldozers, a whole lot of cats in general. I'll need ramps. I'll need some wires to cut quarry rock, revolving wires to quarry rock, and I'll need possibly some sort of a skid road built there in order to get these boulders in there properly, and I'd better have some cranes, yes, some big cranes, some heavy motored cranes in order to lift these. So you say, wait a minute, we gave you 2,500 men. Yeah, but what am I going to do with those? Are they trained operators? You say, what you do with those? Well, you have them flex their muscles and get in there and cut them rocks apart and move them down the line and put them up on top of other rocks. Maybe this guy would just say, oh, no. This would be too much. And yet, although there was quite a bit of ingenuity used in the construction of the pyramids, such as boats which floated themselves and unfloated themselves with their burden of stone, I won't go into the construction of the pyramids, but it was mostly plain, pure brawn. And what man was willing to do with brawn a couple of thousand years ago precluded his necessity for caterpillar tractors. Nowadays, he doesn't really build as heavily with much better equipment. Well, there's the effort band sitting up there, up above figure. Now, psychology has never moved into this band, and now it never will. Freudian analysis never even really approached the band of figure. It was all stimulus response to them. That's the only trouble, really, with psychoanalysis is its tremendous fixation upon association or stimulus response. Free, independent, causative thinking is quite out of their reach. A writer has to be neurotic in order to write. You write because of your neuroses and all that sort of thing. Stimulus response, in other words. Or no writer who is neurotic can write, believe me. A lot of them try, and a lot of people read it. But, as the devil said in Kipling, is it art? Now, here then is a very, very definite progression in the entire field of activity and in the field of mind. And it was the progression of the sex back up toward no. Now, if you think you're going to be able to avoid any one of these lines and getting your pre-clear out, you will continue to be disappointed. You start to process him for 10 minutes to change his thinkingness about sex into from bad sex to good sex, and it doesn't change. Don't be disappointed. The ladder leads in another direction. Good sex and bad sex are not opposite each other. One of them is way, way above the other one, and you've got to climb through a lot of things before you get there. If you know this about the no to sex scale, you will understand the behavior pre-clears as they sit there in front of you. And you won't expect quite so much out of your processing, which it means that you'll get a heck of a lot more activity. You will know when you're progressing. See that? And that is the way you predict progression on a case. Not black to white. It goes from black, gray, 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 lot less gray, pearl gray, vaguely white, white. Okay, continuing now on this no to sex scale, dissertations thereupon and thereof. Its use, of course, in auditing is very wide. But its main use is naturally in prediction of what's going to happen to the preclear. Let's give you an example of this. Preclear starts going through opening procedure by duplication. You usually find him way, way, way down to the bottom someplace. He's frightfully lost. If he's going to have any big lottery actions in opening procedure by duplication, why, he's going to be clear down toward the bottom of it. We're going to find him just in an hour or two of opening procedure by duplication, flipping up through the notice X scale. But will he hit it in an orderly fashion? No, he will hit it. Everything will be in its proper place, but he will miss points. Here you have something that is so condensed, so extremely condensed, the area he's operating in, that he only hit the prominent portions of it on his way up. And the others will go through so fast sometimes that you won't observe them at all. If you were to inquire into them, he might have had a flick of them as they went past. It actually is a manifestation there of actually going over something. And what is this? It's crossing barriers which the individual has already erected to protect himself in the business of livingness. And the names of these barriers are, as he interrupted them, he interrupted a free concourse of life, of first, lookingness. You know, we have to look across a distance to find out what's there. That's the first barrier, he interrupted. You have to perceive across a distance. Instead of just knowing everything around, he figured there was something dangerous to know or something like that. So such consideration entered in there. Now, the next one is emotingness as a protective mechanism. You see, lookingness is space as a protective mechanism. The barrier of space comes into lookingness. All right, now the barrier of a barrage, you might say, of emotional states is the next one. Now, a fellow protects himself, for instance. You would not think of this offhand, a fellow protecting himself by being very serene. A fellow protecting himself by being very enthusiastic. That sure holds them off. If you don't think it does, put somebody on an e-meter sometime and ask him what he thinks about enthusiasm. And the e-meter goes tickety-tick, tickety-tick, you know, a little tiny, very queer little bop goes on to it. You just put preclear after preclear on an e-meter and ask them what they think of enthusiasm. And you get this funny little bop. It's a stuck bop. It's quite peculiar. But it's definitely a barrier. Now we go down below there. Boredom. The way an individual protects himself from enthusiasm, of course, is by not caring. By not accepting it. By so on. He fends off, in other words, with it. Now we go a little bit lower, and we get antagonism as a very overt defense. That's a barrage of particles, you might say. Now we go a little lower than that, and we get anger as a ridge. You know? And that person, you know, he really fends things off from him there. He does a good job of it, too. And as we get down a little bit lower on the band, we get into fear. Well, fear itself, you wouldn't think so offhand, but it is a defense. Fear as a defense. Who the devil wants to close terminals with something in that kind of condition? That's the agreement which has taken place there. This thing is terrified or in fear or something of the sort. Well, fear in animals carries with it a taste. If you go out and chase a deer and scare him real bad before you shoot him, why, don't think that you're going to have a very tasty meal afterwards. Most of your buck hunters... buck fever specialists that go rolling out from the cities with a Holland Express elephant gun to hunt a few little deer out in the brush will quite normally chase them here and chase them there and stir them up here and stir them up there and get them in a very excited and terrified state, you see, and then drop them and then proudly take the buck and throw it over the fender of the car and take it home and then cut out its glands and then serve it up and invite everybody over for a venison dinner, and everybody decides they don't like venison. And next year he doesn't go out. So you see, it's really a protective mechanism. His wife says, if you bring home another deer... Now, that isn't the way a hunter who really knows his business, hunts. I take up in Alaska, a fellow sneak through the muskeg for a while, and he'll find a deer running or frightened or something like that. He just let him go right on by. He'd have to be awful hungry to shoot that deer. And he'll find a deer grazing, minding his own business, so forth. And he drills him straight between the eyes, immediately walks over, cuts out the various glands out of the body. And this meat is extremely tasty. It's very, very smooth flavor. There isn't any of that real wild flavor to it and so forth that most people associate with venison. Here's fear at work. But just being in the vicinity of somebody who is afraid also has its penalty. Now, you can smell fear. There is a manifestation which turns on in auditing. When a man goes through a fear band, if he's been very, very solid under a lower fear band. And, man, it's about all you can do as an auditor to stay in that auditing room because it really smells. I had a fellow doing one turn this on for about 3 days. We brought him all the way up through on out of it. But the point was, he really smelled bad. Funny part of it is, he didn't start to smell bad to him till the last day. He thought this was a good, safe smell. That's fear at work. Now we go down below that, and grief is a protective mechanism, and it works like this. I'm solid here, I can't move, weep, 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 take care of me. That pulls in the enemy. That changes his mind. It's too deep a drop for him. And he reverses on his intentions. So it's protective. But it's a barrier again. It says, you mustn't do certain things to me because I am in sorrow. Now we take apathy. The fellow just lying there. Another word for apathy is eat me. And that in itself is a protective barrier. But it isn't eat me at the upper edge of apathy. It's just a sort of an I don't care. Now you get down into eating. You get, as soon as we drop out of this emotional band, we get a sort of an emotional content to the rest of the band, which is a deeper kind of emotion than you would ordinarily consider emotion. For instance, an apathy is manifested by being violently sick at one's stomach, which is the lower end of the eatingness band. See, that is an apathy. That's the apathy of eatingness, is vomiting. There is an apathy of effort. There's an apathy of thinkingness. See? We can interweave these things, and the reason we can interweave them is because the language wasn't invented to exactly agree with human behavior. There are sort of emotional reactions, you might say, to the rest of this band. There are all kinds of emotional reactions to the band. But this shouldn't upset you because the main manifestation in vomiting is a disgust with eating. And you don't have to worry about whether or not it has an emotional context. See? I mean, they just forget about the emotional context. Now, let's look a little bit more here at the person as he comes up through this effort band, and we find out as he comes through the effort band that he runs into a level of effort the like of which you would never really consider effort at all. It is an inertness, which is so inert that inert doesn't really describe it. It's an inert, I wish to Christ I could be less than inert. See? And that is the level of effort which people experience who are having a rough time with the mind. Effort itself, of course, is observably, to thee and me, a protective barrier, isn't it? Observably. Fellow comes up, he's threatening you, and you shoot him. Direct application of force. He gets too close to you, and you slug him. See? That's definitely a type of protective barrier there. Now we go just below this, and we get thinkingness as a protective barrier. The fellow is figuring out where he will be when something else is elsewhere. Or where he will put something when he himself is not there. And he's placing things in terms of force, but he's figuring it out in advance as to where he's placing things, you see? So he isn't able to use direct effort spontaneously. This comes about where a civilized man, for instance, is unable to carry a revolver with him all the time. He has to figure on where to put his money and how to keep it safe and how to keep people from tripping him up and whether or not somebody's intentions are good, bad, or indifferent. If he were carrying, just in body form, weapons, he'd never think about it at all. See? He just more or less put his back away from the door when he sat down in places and somebody came in who looked friendly. Why, fine, they're friendly. Shake him by the hand, have him sit down. That's perfectly all right with him. If they look hostile, kill him. I mean, simple. This is what you might say very basic and primitive logic. Now, we get symbols as a barrier. We've already smacked a little bit of mystery. And we've gotten into don't look in here, it might be dangerous, as a protective barrier. And that's symbols. Don't look in here, it might be dangerous. And I'm really not here, I am elsewhere. Attack this symbol if you like, because it isn't I. See the protective mechanism that is used there. Now, we drop down again. We find eating this, of course, is a method of really getting attention. That fellow could really be secure when he eats. He knows very, very well that he's gotten that attention. No doubt left in his mind as to whether or not something gave him attention. He's got his full stomach. And this is a comfortable feeling, whether it's any good physiologically or whether people really do use this stuff for energy is completely beside the point. It is very satisfying to have a full stomach. All right. Let's look at sex and find out that this is a barrier of escape into the future. If an individual can't live in the present, of course, this is where the symbol, by the way, can't any longer live in the present. So we have got a big system by which a symbol can now appear on the future track. And we can now have that symbol. You can run a thetan this way, by the way. You can have him say, all right, now get the idea of putting something there. And now moving out, and now coming back and finding what you put there. And we can just go on doing this with him, you know. Now get the idea of putting something there. And he says, what do you mean? You say anything. Just get the idea of putting something there. Now going away and coming back and finding it. And that's very satisfying to him. See? Well, that is the action of sex. He puts something there, form grows, and he therefore could get this particular form, symbol, body, knocked off, and then he'd come back and he'd find that there was another body. Real cute. Well, that is sex as a protective mechanism. Now, it's more than that as a protective mechanism. Sex offered is don't eat me. A woman, for instance, can say to a man, look, there are more things to do than simply eat each other. See? It's something else to do. More forceful and brutally, a little higher scale on the thing, of course, just eat each other up. Well, sex is a substitute for eating each other up. It's an interesting mechanism. Here you can have all this tasty emotion, and you don't have to have all this tasty flesh. Now, you get all of these things that come down as protective barriers. Individual has actually gotten himself snarled into these protective barriers. At the point where you pick him up, he feels insufficiently safe without these barriers. So he sort of likes to make a test run of it. Which one of the barriers can you get him to drop in order to attack the next barrier? Well, of course, every time he put up a thing as a barrier to protect him, he made it senior to him, which is why we call it a dwindling spiral. If he used effort to protect himself, therefore he considered effort senior to him. His consideration was that effort is greater than he is. You go out and ask almost anybody if he thinks he's bigger than a bullet, and he will tell you, well, if you mean a bullet fired straight at me, and you say yes. No, no, I'm not. And yet such a person, even a police officer carrying a gun, would depend upon that for his protection, and yet at the same time would consider it senior to himself. He's able to do more damage than he can do. Dependency, then, upon these things for protection. Now let's take another line on all these things. How about using each one of these barriers as an overt level? And there we get the dispersal manifestation all the way down the line. Now, what have we just been going over? We've been going over the ridge manifestation all the way down the line. These ridge manifestations are what one uses for defense. The dispersal manifestations are what one uses for offense. So, you have on the notice X scale, in each level, a ridge manifestation. And on the notice, that's electronic standing ridges. We mean just that. And as we go down the line, we find at each level a dispersal manifestation, which is offense. But, of course, dispersal is also interwoven with defense. And ridges are also interwoven with offense. But the principal thing used in offense is dispersal, motion, movement, flows. And the principal things used in defenses are ridges. So we get tears as a defense. Then somewhere right in the vicinity of grief, there must be a dispersal of some kind or another. And it is an emotion which really isn't quite well detected simply because it isn't named. But it is there. In apathy, you get the ridge manifestation, but there's also the dispersal manifestation. If a person is in apathy, he can be stirred up a little bit so as to disperse out of there. And you have gotten the dispersal manifestation of apathy. He'll manifest in a certain way. So that when you run somebody, you go up through ridges and dispersals, which is all we're getting down to, on the sex up to no scale, and you run him through the sex to no scale many times. Now we get over to the other way you could draw this notice sex scale, and that is to say, we could start in at the top, and fairly widely and loosely, we would draw a scale coming down, but just a little way, and it would contain everything, no to sex. We'd just be just a little way down from the top of the tone scale, and now we would go into no again, of a minor and lesser order, and then get into look of a lesser order, and emotion of a lesser order, and effort of a lesser order, and so forth. We'd go right on down to sex again, and then we would start right below that, and we would go no, and we would go on down to sex again, and then below that sex, that new sex, we would start with a new no, and we would go on down to sex again, and below that particular last sex, we would have a new no, which would go right on down to sex again, and so on. In other words, we could just get a series of the scale itself, each series being more condensed than the last series of the scale itself. And this is what you see when you start running opening procedure in by duplication. Apollo, let's say we had this thing repeated on the scale 50 times. We had notice X there 50 times, each time the notice X scale itself more condensed. See? And we see this fellow start in, and he's hanging up down along the line here someplace at effort. And he can barely tolerate this effort. And he flies up into an emotion. And then he knows that this is silly or something of the sort. And makes a remark about sex, or has a fleetingly sexual impulse of some sort or another, and then has some sort of a statement about figure-figure, or he has an impulse toward figure-figure, and then there's a new kind of knowingness shows up. And then we have, just as he goes out up the scale, he's got some remark about eating, and then he emotes in some fashion or another, and then he looks in some new style, and then we find him with a new effort. What's he doing here? He's down in ranges, which are so darn condensed, but as he starts up the line, he'll just hit high spots as he goes through these lower ridges. And we find a fragment of the scale showing up every time he runs up the scale. And we get the first time he ran the first band that he hit that he was going to improve on was very low, and it contained all the elements of sex to know, but it was so darn jammed that when he hit it, this is the way it looked to you as an auditor. He hit a little effort. He looked in a peculiar way, and now he was up into the upper eatingness band. We make some remark about eating. They quite often do this. They say, "What do you expect me to do now? Eat it?" They say they look at it in some peculiar way, or they sneer at it. in some fashion, and then look at it very peculiarly. And so you just see him running the notice X, the sex to no band upwards, just sex to no. Now we're up in a little higher gradient of sex to no, and a little higher gradient of sex to no, and a little higher gradient of sex to no, and a little higher gradient of sex to no, and a little higher gradient of sex to no, and they seem to linger in these upper ones longer. They linger in them longer, which is to say, they pick up more particularities of each one. And if we were running really the upper sex to no band here, oh boy, would you find manifestations. You would probably find 13, 14 varieties of interest on good sex, you know? They'd find all these manifestations. In other words, the sex scale itself would have opened up here to a remarkably differentiated scale. And that is the keynote of it. As you get higher and higher scale levels, you get better and better differentiation. Down at the bottom there, he got identification to the such that effort was sex. And this, of course, was what you thought. And this is the way you thought. I mean, total differentiation. That's an insane condition. You went up a little bit higher, and you had a person, emotion was mixed up with sex. Anytime some other sexed individual, you know, like, let's say your preclear was a girl, anytime a man became emotional in any way, she would connect this with sexual overtness on his part. You know, any emotional expression which he made, or any lookingness which he did, of course, she just attributed this to sex. In other words, she's on a band where sex, lookingness, you know, lookingness is sex, is figure, is effort, is knowingness, is all these things. They're just all short circuits, you see. It isn't that she is concentrated on sex. It's just all these things are all these things. A man, of course, is sex, and that's why he puts out effort. And obviously, this is all it is to emotion. I've seen people explain this very happily. They explain this in a very wide fashion. They say, well, of course, it all amounts really to sex in the long run. Psychoanalysts, for instance, because when people look at things, they have a sexual attitude about it, and when they know anything that's worth knowing, of course, that is a sexual thing, and so forth. Well, somebody just picked out any part of the note of sex scale and said, this is it. If those same people had effort pointed out to them as the keynote of this scale, you see, they just said, well, sex connects to effort, and of course that's really lookingness, and when you get all through, that's all you need to know about would just be effort or something like that. Well, that brings us up another thing. They never would have done this because of this. Now, let's now draw this scale in such a way as to demonstrate a dropping dominance. Now, how many parts are there on the note of sex scale? There's no, look, emote, effort, thinkingness, symbols, eatingness, and sex. There are 8 parts to that scale. Is that right? Unless I've missed one. All right. Now, up above here, we would find each one with its, at the highest level, we'd find each one with more or less the same emphasis. You know, these are just parts of life. Sex is sex. I mean, the fellow says, well, it's really effort. This person who was on this upper band would say, sex is effort? So how would sex be effort? Let's see. I don't get that. Sex, effort, rather incomprehensible. Well, the fellow says, you kind of have to scrunch it all down, you see, to look at it that way. Now we go down into the first harmonic of the scale below that, and you would find the fellow's emphasis. All the factors were there, but the fellow's emphasis would be on knowingness. And each one of the factors would be colored by the fact that you should also know about them, you see. It wasn't enough just to experience them. You also had to know about them. Now let's go down and drop to the third harmonic from the top, and find out that all these factors are there, but what you do with them, you see, is look. And that's kind of the state of a Thetan when you get him well up tone scale. He stands around and he looks, you know. It's very satisfying to him. He just loves to look. He looks and looks. He looks at sex, he looks at effort, he looks at figuring, he It's a fascinating game to him, but the whole band is colored by perceive. Now let's drop down one more harmonic and find out that the whole band is there, notice X, but it's colored this place by emotion. And let's drop down one more band and find out that this next band, and this characterizes the heavy effort societies, the Germanic society and so forth, where everything is colored by effort. You might say the Italian society, everything is colored by emotion. But the Germanic type of society, everything would be colored by effort. Sex would be colored by effort. Knowing this, what's the best thing to know about? Effort, of course. Now, what is there about emotion that is terribly interesting and that we ought to look at and study? Well, the effort that is contained in emotion. Well, about thinking, the amount of effort that we have to put into this problem in order to think it out, and so on. The whole band, in other words, sex. We have to count the fact that a body contains so much weight while performing the sexual act. All of these things, a symbol, for instance, it's more important how forcefully the symbol is written, so that all the symbols that you get in such a society are big, broad, slashing, bold symbols, you know, and the mysteries themselves sort of jump out and hit you in the face. Nothing airy about all this. And we drop down to the next band of notice X. Now we're dropping, you know, each time we've got all the notice X scale there, and we find out it's covered by figure. And we have the Latin society characteristic that we see in Latin America, quite different than the Mediterranean type of Latin society, you might say, Latin American society. Figure. A manifestation that in this country is most prominent in Southern California. There's always something else that you'd better figure about. You know, out at the University of Southern California, I think it is, or the University of Los Angeles. I think it's the University of Los Angeles. Every drinking fountain has the thing, you're here to learn how to think, or some such sign. You know, think. Their big fort is education. They might not be able to make anybody able to fix plumbing or dig a ditch, but boy, can they get them to pack educational facts. They teach them how to think, and they leave them rather free about what to think and how to think. Not bad, but it colors the rest of the band. You're supposed to think about sex. You're supposed to think about symbols. You're supposed to think about effort. You always act according to a long plan. You're supposed to think about emotion. Now, let's not emote about the thing. Let's think about it. You're supposed to think before you look. Think before you go. Think before you know. That is the coloration of that particular band. Now let's drop down to another one and find out that its emphasis, of course, would be on symbols. Nobody would think about anything particularly, but boy, would they have lots of symbols. You know, symbols for everything. Boy, that'd be an erudite society. You'd have more books that had less in them, but boy, there sure'd be symbols all over the place. And you'd walk down halls and everything, so that effort would be characterized by a symbol. It would be a society of mathematicians, where symbols did it all. You didn't have to think at all. The formulas and the symbols did it all for you. Now we drop down another band, and we would find out that the main purpose of existence was, of course, eating. And the reason we exerted effort, and the reason we emoted and everything else, this all had to do with eating. There are such societies. And the last one, of course, it would be all sex. And the reason we eat, and the reason we think, and the reason we be, and the reason we emote, and the reason we look, and so forth, are all sex. So there's an emphasis as it goes down. Now, when it strikes that band and goes down into the lower bands than that, it starts to get dreadfully compressed, believe me. We aren't expressing an allness here, which is differentiated allness. We're getting an identification which is as strong as effort is sex. You see, the fellow says sex, and this immediately effort. He says effort, and this is immediately sex. There's no real differentiation in the note. Look, how bad off is your preclear? It's how badly he is emphasizing on this. If he's in those harmonics which I just described, the last one of which was everything is colored by sex, he's still all right. He's pretty much all right. But if he goes much below that, he's nutty. And when you get him on the opening procedure by duplication, if you could ever get him to do it at all, he would start flying out at all angles and would eventually merge into one of these lower bands of the notice sex scale, and you would see a marked change in his case. For the first time, he'd be able to differentiate from one to the other of these things. This is a notice sex scale and is a method of predicting a case. And you can predict its recovery and predict also how long it's going to take to recover, how long it's going to take him to differentiate. Okay.